When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button. Drinking Buddies, a comedy from Joe Swanberg about relationships and really good beer, starring Olivia Wilde and Anna Kendrick, is available to watch on demand before it hits theaters. And Rachel McAdams stars in Brian De Palma's erotic thriller Passion, available on demand August 1st before its theatrical release. The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The art house is now in your house. This episode is also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code SVU7. From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer. On this episode of SVU, it's been just over a year since the Battle of New York. Now, beyond the hype, beyond the buzz, beyond the anticipation, and beyond the Thunderdome, we take a look back at the Avengers. Later in the show, we'll bring you Q Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites and services. All centered around a common theme, inspired by the Avengers, we were going to do an episode entirely about the old British TV show called The Avengers, and Allison was actually going to rank all 161 episodes in order. She spent months working on this. She rewatched every single episode. But unfortunately, Allison had to go out of town on a business trip, so instead, I'm here with a very special guest, Jordan Hoffman, the film critic from Screen Crush and Film.com. And together we're going to talk about comic book movies that are currently available online. Jordan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I am wearing an Emma Peel costume, though, so that's okay.
Fantastic.
Right?
It's still in keeping. It's a different Avengers, but that's all right. I may break into my Sean Connery impression at some point.
We can only hope so.
That was the movie, but not the TV show. But that was the other movie that was called The Avengers. So I think it's all still in the...
Well, the film that we'll be talking about today is not called The Avengers, my friend.
What is
that
it called?
The movie is called Marvel's The Avengers. That is the official title in the U.S. And in the U.K., it's called Marvel's Avengers Assemble.
Perhaps to differentiate it from the British Avengers that
absolutely
people know and love. But here, nobody knows that, so it doesn't matter.
But here in the States, it is tech. I am one of these guys that loves to call movies, you know, what they're actually called. Like, my favorite thing in the world is to discuss the film Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. So I really like talking about films with the even if it's a weird name. And the movie we'll be discussing is Marvel's The Avengers.
So we have that to look forward to later, you saying Marvel's The Avengers over and over again.
Yes, yes. I do have some problems that I'm working on, and this is one of them. But, you know, until it's settled, that's what I'll be doing.
All right. Well, fantastic. That'll be a little later. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. And our first pick this week is one of my favorite movies of the year so far. It's called Trance, directed by Danny Boyle. It's now available on VOD. And it is the latest film from Danny Boyle, who directed 127 Hours and Sunshine, 28 Days Later, and the movie that gave Film Spotting its name, Trainspotting. And this film is a heist mystery It's about a guy who's played by James McAvoy who steals and hides a priceless painting, but then wouldn't you know it, Jordan, he gets conked on the noggin by Vincent Cassell. I hate it when that happens. He forgets where he put the painting. So to try to remember where he put it, he gets sent to a hypnotist who's played by Rosario Dawson, and she tries to jog his memory.
Where are you now?
I'm in the hallway. The doors are locked.
All the doors are locked.
Go upstairs to Frank's bedroom. There's a pool and a hallway. Do you see the bedside table?
Yes.
Open the drawer. No, the lower one. Is there a gun?
Yes.
Do you think you can use it?
I don't know. I've never used one before.
Do you want me to call the police?
No.
The movie got, I would say, decent reviews when it came out. It was mostly described as a pleasant trifle, but I actually ended up seeing it twice because I ended up talking about it twice with two different film discussion groups that I host in New York City. And I actually found that it was a really fun movie to rewatch, to think about more, and to talk about. There's a lot going on here kind of beneath that very beautiful surface, and there are some choices that I did question, mostly revolving around Rosario Dawson's character and the depiction on screen of what I'm going to call her Good China, let's say. And I liked the film overall, though. I found it kind of an interesting return for Danny Boyle to some of the themes that he covered early in his career in Trainspotting, and especially in his first feature, Shallow Grave. Jordan, did you see Trance?
Well, you know, it's funny. You saw it twice, and that's why I didn't see it once, because you took my turn. No. It's funny. I meant to see it, and then I didn't see it, actually. I heard about it, though. And frankly, you're among the few people I know who liked it.
Well, those people are wrong, and I was right. But it is a good movie. I recommend you check it out. That's Trance. It's available now. We've got two more quick picks for you. I haven't seen any of these films, but I'm looking forward to checking both of them out. The first one is called Ginger and Rosa. It's directed by Sally Potter, and it's available now on VOD. And this film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. And it stars Elle Fanning and Alice Englert. They played two teenage girls in London in the 1960s. And it's like a coming-of-age story amidst, you know, everything that was going on that decade, the Cultural Revolution, and I think the threat of nuclear war also kind of weighs heavily on the subject matter. Another highly acclaimed film. I didn't get a chance to see this one. I want to see it. Did you see this one? Did you review this one at all, Jordan?
Which one, Ginger and Rosa?
Yes.
It's very embarrassing. This is the second one I haven't seen. I've had a copy of this on my desk for a really long time, but I didn't have to review it, so it's always been on the – I'm going to get to this one soon. I really would like to see it, though, because I like the leading actress, that young woman named Alice Englert, because I saw her in a movie that isn't good, but she was great in it. I saw her in – Beautiful Creatures.
Ah.
It's a movie that is basically forgotten. It was one of these would-be
like
young
a Twilight
adult
knockoff,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
It was a Twilight knockoff that was actually – it wasn't good, but it had a lot going on. What's his name? Jeremy Irons is very, very funny. And the lead is this young Alice Englert, who, by the way, happens to be Jane Campion's daughter.
Ah.
So, you know, if you were curious – for the People magazine set out there. But she was great in it. And then I know that she plays, well, either Ginger or Rosa. I don't know which one.
All right.
It's a 50-50. And so I do want to see it. And Sally Potter's an interesting filmmaker. Not all of her stuff is good. Did you ever see that movie she made called Yes?
I haven't.
I got one word for you on that one. That word is no.
Ba-dum-bum.
Yes is not a very good movie. But it's also interesting. Like, it's all done in iambic pentameter, and it just doesn't really work. But nevertheless, I didn't see Ginger and Rosa. I will before the end of the year, like the other one you mentioned, Trance.
All right. Well, that's Ginger and Rosa. It's now available. And last but not least...
I hope I saw this last one. Otherwise, I'm going to be really embarrassed.
I don't think you have, because I don't think anyone's seen this one yet. It's going to be available on VOD on August 2nd. It's called The Canyons, directed by Paul Schrader.
Oh, God. The Canyons. Yeah.
And it's from Paul Schrader. That's the writer of Taxi Driver, the director of many films like American Gigolo and Affliction. So much has been written about the making of this movie. Not much has been written about the movie itself, because not a lot of people have seen it yet. But it was a rocky production. There was a lengthy and fascinating New York Times profile about Schrader and the making of the movie, and in particular about his struggle to control his star, which would be Lindsay Lohan. The film also stars porn star James Dean and film director Gus Van Sant. It's going to be playing very soon, and it's going to be premiering on VOD on August 2nd. This episode of Film Spotting SVU is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. And at Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect image or video for your next creative project, whether it's for your website, a publication, advertisement, video, or any other type of project. You can choose from over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D or 3D animation, and motion graphics. And they have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. Shutterstock sources clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips with contributors that are professional filmmakers and animators. And they review each video individually for content and quality before adding it to their library. And they add over 10,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new. Shutterstock has sophisticated search tools, so you can search and drill down by category, resolution, contributor, and more. They also have shareable clip boxes and a huge image library of photos, vectors, icons, and infographic templates for all your creative needs. Shutterstock has flexible pricing, and you can choose between individual clips or video packs, and you can download clips in HD or by standard def or web formats. Shutterstock is a complete global offering with offices in more than a dozen countries, and it's a true global marketplace for buyers and creative contributors. They've got multilingual customer service with dedicated corporate reps and full-time customer support throughout the week. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. You just start an account and start using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. If you decide to purchase, use offer code SVU7 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. And for 30% off new accounts, use offer code SVU7. We thank Shutterstock for their support. So we were supposed to have a discussion this week about the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. That's going to be our next listener's choice review. But Allison really wanted to be here to do that, so we decided to push that off for one show. She'll be back on the next episode, and we'll talk about that then. And that left us, you know, without a subject. And I asked Jordan if he wanted to come on and be our guest host this week, and he was gracious enough to do that. And so thinking about what we could talk about, I thought it might be a good time to talk about comic book movies. For one thing, I know it's a subject that's near and dear to both of our hearts. Jordan and I are both longtime comic book readers and fans. And we're in the middle of the summer here where we're just kind of inundated with them, to the point where I don't know how you feel, Jordan, but I almost feel like my comic book fandom is being tested at some points during these summers when some of these movies come out and they're so horrible. You know, there was a long time where I almost felt obligated to see every single one, even if I didn't care about the characters or anything, just because I wanted to support the notion of movies based on these things because I loved seeing them. Now, I don't think that they really need my support, but there was a while where I would go see anything that was a comic book movie, you know. And
I agree. I mean, comic book movies are not going away because they're in development well until 2017, 2018 or whatever. I do think that the Marvel juggernaut will not die, and the Marvel movies are great, both the ones that Marvel Studios are doing and, by and large, the ones that Fox, at least X-Men First Class, I thought was really great. And the Sony ones are okay. But, you know, it looks like there's going to be some new DC stuff happening, and that's pretty good. But there are still these other ones. I mean, keep in mind, I think RIPD was technically a comic book movie, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I can't speak about it with too much firsthand knowledge because I avoided that one. I don't know if you sat through that, but
I haven't seen it yet. That was one that really tested that obligation thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those ones
about.
Where it's, that's exactly right. I mean, that's one of those ones where it's like, I don't really feel like I need to see that. But I think we're at a stage where summer movies are going to be, by and large, the Marvel and DC franchises are going to be the big center stuff, you know, for years and years. Luckily, those characters resonate for a reason. They're usually pretty great, and there have been some missteps, but by and large, I think they're pretty good.
I mean, it is funny though to talk about it in this way. Like, I really did used to feel like I was sort of like supporting this cult hobby that I had to go see comic book movies. You know, like, get out the vote kind of a thing. And now, exactly. And this little obsession that I almost, you know, it was almost like a guilty pleasure of mine, you know, in high school. I didn't tell people that I read comic books. You know, it was like a dirty secret because it was like the least cool thing you could do. And now these are the most mainstream movies of, you know, these are the movies that play to the widest audiences, to tens of millions of people. And I just think it's kind of unbelievable. I mean, if you had told me that when I was a freshman in high school, I would have thought you were kidding. I would have thought, you know, someone was playing a cruel Dickens-esque, you know, Ghost of Christmas Future prank on me, you know, like, look what's going to happen, and I would not have believed it.
But it's still, I mean, you still enjoy them for what they are. I mean, I think the Marvel films, the sort of quote-unquote official Marvel Universe films are all very good. Even the ones that are problematic are still pretty damn good, and I thought Man of Steel was a lot of fun. You know, I think sort of the big tentpoles are still are nothing to be ashamed of, right?
No, but I will, you know, I will say, and we don't want to talk too generally for too long. We want to get into our picks here. But I do sometimes wonder if in that transition from cult niche thing to super mainstream thing, if some of the flavor that I loved and some of the weirdness and oddness about the original properties sometimes gets lost. And maybe even gets lost in the movies, whereas compared to the movies of yesteryear to some degree, it gets lost. You know, when comic book movies were not big business, they were allowed to be a little weirder and funkier and maybe in some ways more, I don't know if satisfying is the word, but it's kind of entertainingly strange. And now they are, you know, they're mainstream and they really are easily digestible. And they are at times quite wonderful. And I do like a lot of the movies that Marvel and DC have put out. But I don't know. I need you to be my therapist, I think, on this episode, Jordan, because I am sort of – I have this sort of like tension, this push-pull within me between that 15-year-old kid who loved comic books and still does. I went to the comic book store earlier tonight. I bought some – it's Wednesday as we're recording this, and I bought some new comic books. But I also, you know, I'm the film guy who watches movies and wants the movies to be great, and it's like it's not enough for them to be great – quote-unquote adaptations to me. You know, it's not enough to just put a really great version of Iron Man on the screen. It's got to be a great movie to me as well.
The current modern comic book movie is a very curious and specific genre unto itself, you know, and kind of new in a way. But, you know, you were talking about days of yore when comic book movies could be a little bit weirder. That actually leads – it's a great segue to – one of the three picks that I have for my three picks that are currently streaming.
All right, well, let's get into it. What's your first pick?
The first pick I have is what I think at the end of the day is probably my favorite Batman movie.
Ooh.
It's Batman Returns.
Mm.
Not Batman, period.
An unusual, unorthodox pick.
And not The Dark Knight, although I like The Dark Knight. Batman Returns just kills me because it's a very interesting mix of straightforward Batman tale, but it's a little bit campy and goofy. Of course, the third one that came after it was not directed by Tim Burton. It was the start. It was the beginning of the end. It was when Joel Schumacher took over and screwed it all up. But I think that Batman Returns is just weird enough. And what I love so much about it is the look of the thing, particularly now. The movie's 20 years old. And it really looks dated. Usually that's a bad thing. But when you look at it now, you can just see everything as a set. You know, you can see that 10 feet over there is the catering table. And for whatever reason, I find that very endearing, maybe because I'm used now to Christopher Nolan's style of the Batman films being all on location and, you know, just shooting in Chicago, just shooting in Manhattan or wherever, and it looking very real. This is just, you know, really stylized. There are like the fight scenes are like dance routines. It's all very garish with the colors. It's got almost like a campy kind of a Like there are parts of it that almost have like a kitschy 50s vibe, particularly in Selena Kyle's apartment. It's almost got a little bit of a John Waters appeal to it in certain scenes. So the look of it I love. And I mean, Danny DeVito as the Penguin is just fantastic. I mean, he's really incredible. Christopher Walken as Max Schreck is very entertaining. And, you know, Michael Keaton's a good Batman too. And Michelle Pfeiffer is great. Both in the Catwoman suit and out of it. So if you haven't seen it in a while, or if you maybe never saw it, which is possible, check it out. You certainly don't need to see the first Batman before. You can just jump right in. But the set pieces are really very stagey in a way, but it's still a cool Batman film. I mean, he's got cool gadgets, and Michael Keaton is still kind of a badass once he gets the cape and cowl on there.
Hi.
Listen, I'm sorry about yesterday, but I had a pretty big deal come through, fall through, actually.
It's okay. I had to go home and feed my cat.
So, how are you doing?
Actually, semi-hard, I'd say.
Have you watched this one lately, or has it been a long time for you?
It's probably been a bunch of years. I'm trying to think when the last time I saw it was, but I have fond memories of seeing it as a kid, and you do go back and look at it now and go, boy, this movie is pretty weird. You know, for a mainstream movie, for a sequel to a really big hit, the first Batman was, and I guess that was what gave Burton the capital to do what he wanted and make this movie so strange. It is weird, and it's dark, and all the stuff with Penguin and his background and Catwoman, her origin.
Penguin's story is really dark and creepy. He's an abandoned child. He's deformed. He's living in the sewer with a bunch of other penguins. It's very, very strange.
Right. He's not the comic book Penguin who's just like a little, a short guy in a tuxedo. He has this ghoulish kind of look. He looks like something out of Beetlejuice or something. He's like a monster, and it is a really good Danny DeVito performance. So yeah, I think it's a good pick. I like it. So where is that available again?
Oh, you can rent this one all over the place: Amazon, iTunes, Vudu, YouTube, for a low fee, and it's worth every penny.
All right, my first pick is going to be paired quite nicely with that because it's also a Batman movie. It's Batman the Movie from 1966, directed by Leslie H. Martinson and available on Netflix. And I think I mentioned earlier, Jordan, like when I was a kid, it was not cool to be a comic book fan. And as a comic book fan, the least cool thing you could do was be an old school Batman TV show fan. That was lower than the low. That was lower than the Mole Man and his mole people to drop a nerdy reference.
Absolutely.
So this was, this was sort of like a forbidden text almost when I was a kid, And I've been glad to see people kind of coming around to it a little bit lately. DC is actually publishing a brand new comic book series called Batman 66, which is in the style of the old show. It has like the likenesses of Adam West and Burt Ward. It's campy. It's fun. It's silly. I actually have the first issue sitting here. I just got it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm dying to read it. And I'm glad people are kind of coming around to it. On the one hand, I get the frustration that comic book fans had with the show, because for such a long time, this was like the stereotype of what a comic book was to a lot of people. When you said comic book,
Biff Bam Pow.
That's
right.
It was still maybe 10 years ago where if you were writing like in a newspaper, if someone was writing an article about comic books, that the stereotypical headline was like, Biff Zot Bam, comics aren't just for kids anymore. Like that article was still being written 10 years ago, and this show was the reason. And
and you would quake with frustration.
That's right. And I would shake my nerdy fist at the sky and say, no, it's not true. But you know what? Now that comic books are mainstream, now that they've come out of that sort of cult thing, out of that stereotype, I think the stigma isn't there anymore, and I think we're willing to enjoy the show on its own merits, which is great, because this show and the movie, this is the movie specifically, they're so much fun. And in this case, the movie was made between seasons of the show, I think the first and second seasons,
right.
And it has the look and the style of the show.
It's the same production. It's like watching three episodes in a row, basically.
Basically, right. Yeah. You have Adam West and Burt Ward as Batman and Robin. The one sort of hitch is that it's got like the murderer's row of Batman's, you know, rogues gallery. You get the Joker, the Riddler, the Penguin, and Catwoman all at the same time. Cesar Romero, Frank Gorshin, Burgess Meredith, and Lee Merriweather, who deserves a yeah, I think, if anyone.
Is that the truth? Where's Yvonne Craig in all this? To her too.
She's not. She hadn't been introduced on the show as Batgirl yet.
I would watch the show all the time when I was a kid, and when it was an episode that Yvonne Craig wasn't in, I would be very upset, but I was too young to know why.
I mean, the show is, it's camp. It's very 60s camp. It's almost like the icon of 60s camp on television. But you know what? You watch it. It's totally self-aware. It's very much making fun of itself. You know, like you mentioned, you know, when Batman is attacked by a shark and he just happens to have bat shark repellent spray on hand, you're making a knowing, winking comedy. It's a deliberate gag. And I kind of enjoy it. I enjoy the fact that it comes from a time when comic book movies didn't have to all be so super serious. I like the fact that the movie thinks that it's absurd that there is such a thing as Batman. It's fun. Like, I can get into that idea.
Listen to these riddles. Tell me if you interpret them as I do. One, what has yellow skin and writes?
A ballpoint banana.
Right. Two, what people are always in a hurry?
Russian people? Russians.
Right again. Now, what would you say they mean?
Banana? Russian. I've got it. Someone Russian is going to slip on a banana peel and break their neck.
Precisely, Robin. The only possible meaning.
I like that there are the serious Batman as well. I like the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, but I like the variety. I like feeling that that there's a variety of things out there. And it was no fun when Batman, the show, the comedy thing, was the only stereotype. And I don't like it either when all the movies are too serious. I like the variety. So that's why I like Batman, the movie, and that's available now on Netflix.
Well, that's also a lot like the comics, too. Different runs have different vibes.
Absolutely.
Writers have different vibes.
Absolutely.
Some are funnier, some are darker. I think Chris Nolan's films could use from a little Chief O'Hara. I think Chief O'Hara would be great in there. So
that would be nice. All right, what's your next pick?
Okay, all right, we're sticking with a lot of the DC comics here, but I wanted to point out to maybe some listeners who don't know that are hardcore into comics or would like to be more hardcore into comics that for a number of years now, I think 5-6 years, maybe even more, DC has been putting out a pretty damn good animated feature films direct to video. They're about an hour long, an hour and 10, some maybe an hour and 20. And they've been for, you know, all the, what they usually do is they take a well-known comic arc or what we call in the biz, a trade paperback and turn it into an animated short, animated film. There's two that I really wanted to spotlight because a controversial topic is the Green Lantern film, feature film, the Martin Campbell. Was that his name, Martin Campbell?
Yep, Martin Campbell.
Martin
directed
Campbell,
it.
Ryan Reynolds.
Yep.
That whole thing, which is a whole can of worms getting into, but by and large, most people would call that an unsuccessful film. There is an animated version of the Green Lantern origin story, which came out in 2009, called Green Lantern First Flight, directed by a woman named Lauren Montgomery, and Lauren Montgomery directs all the good animations. She does all the Avatar The Last Airbender and a lot of other cool stuff, too. In this, it's basically an origin story. It's Hal Jordan is voiced by Christopher Maloney. Sinestro is Victor Garber. Trisha Helfer from Battlestar Galactica is Boudica. And Michael Madsen is Kilowog. And if you don't know who all these people are, they're members of the Green Lantern Corps. So don't worry about it too much. But basically, he's the test pilot, and he gets zipped up to Oa, and he becomes the Green Lantern. And it's snappy. It's fun. It has a lot. It has a lot less of the baggage that the other movie had. And it's a really great way to sink your teeth into what I think is one of the best. I'm a huge Green Lantern fan, and this one is just really nifty.
This lantern contains the battery that powers all the rings. It also contains all the known information of the cosmos. The sort of atlas and who's who of space. We're going to be playing in Sector 1215. You need to be brought up to speed. Stick your ring in the light. Think 1215, and the battery will do the rest.
And then there was another one. If that's your first taste, that one gets you in. Then if you really get into Green Lantern, they made a follow-up, which is hardcore. It's called Green Lantern Emerald Knights. Now, most sincere Green Lantern fans know that there's never just one Green Lantern comic that's happening at one time. There's, I think lately under the new DC, there's like four of them. It's crazy. But the best one is always what's called Green Lantern Corps, which is, you know, the Green Lantern are space cops, and they're crazy weirdo aliens doing things in space. From the smallest to the highest, there is a Green Lantern member, which is the size of a little insect called Bzzzt. And then there's Mogo, which is a sentient planet. And then, of course, when Alan Moore was writing Green Lantern, there was one that was a sentient mathematical equation. So what Green Lantern Emerald Knights does, friends, is really, really dive into the weirdo, hardcore short stories of Green Lantern lore. It takes usually single-issue comics that were previously written. In fact, one of them is based on an Alan Moore story, the Mogo Doesn't Socialize story. And then some of them are new. And for the movie's 84 minutes, but it's like six or so little shorts. And the animation style is bonkers. I mean, part of the thing that I love about Green Lantern is that, you know, it's very trippy. It's like Doctor Strange for Marvel. Green Lantern these days is just wild and colorful. They really get it well in this little film. And I believe that one of the animation companies, because they're different shorts, so they divvied out the animation to different companies. And some of them were, I could be speaking out of school, I probably should fact check this before I say it, but I'm pretty sure that some of them were anime companies. So they have, like, you know, a wild look is what I'm trying to say. So those two movies are out there. They're streaming on Amazon Prime, Xfinity, StreamPix, Redbox Instant. They're all over the place. And then you can also rent them at iTunes. And they're a blast, and they're very colorful. And if it's a late night haze, man, and you want to watch the Emerald Knights one, that's one to do it to. I'm telling you, the first flight is, if you thought the Green Lantern movie sucked, watch that. What you have to do.
Yeah. All right. My next, we're going to finally get into the world of Marvel here with my next pick, which is I'm going to have to defend this one too, I guess, a little bit. I'm going to recommend The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, a television movie from 1989, directed by Bill Bixby, and available now on Hulu. I think several of the Incredible Hulk TV movies, which were made several years after the Incredible Hulk TV show, are available on Hulu. I think at least two of them, maybe three of them, are available on Hulu, as well as some of the original episodes of the show. And the show from television, if you've never seen it, was sort of like The Fugitive, the setup of The Fugitive. It was like a man traveling each week, getting into different adventures each week, almost like an anthology series with one character who recurred each time. And in this case, that character was the Hulk, was Dr. David Banner, played by Bill Bixby. And I guess the effects, quote-unquote, of The Incredible Hulk, both the show and the TV movies, they're not what they are in something like The Avengers, which we're going to talk about later. Certainly. There's no comparison, almost. In the case of the TV show and these TV movies, the Hulk was not a computer effect. It was a guy. It was Lou Ferrigno, the bodybuilder, who smeared on a whole bunch of green paint and put on really what might be one of the worst wigs I've ever seen.
That was a wig?
Okay, oh my God. It was his real hair. It was his real hair. He didn't even have to dye it. Lou Ferrigno has very strange hair. No, but it was a little silly, that this guy in green paint running around. But you know what? What I really like about it, and what I think is kind of missing from some of the movie versions, not just of the Hulk, but of other comic book characters, is that the TV show and this TV movie, The Trial of the Incredible Hulk, which I rewatched part of. I've seen it before a couple of times as a kid. I had a treasured bootleg of this when these were not available for the days of streaming, when you had to go to comic book conventions and buy bootlegs of these things. I had one of this. Is that it? David Banner is an interesting character in this. He's haunted. He's wounded. Bill Bixby gives a really great performance. You know, this is like the signature thing that Bill Bixby was known for as an actor, was playing the Hulk. And how many actors can you say that now about, Jordan? About actors who, they do these comic book movies and it becomes like a signature role. I think you would say it about Robert Downey Jr., certainly as Iron Man. But for most of the guys playing these parts, I almost feel like they're interchangeable. You know, they find a guy who's not very well known. Who's a good actor. He does a good job for two or three movies. Then his paycheck, you know, his asking price goes up. They replace him with somebody else, and you just repeat that cycle. And the performances are okay, but they're not, you know, great. And I really think that that's something that's missing, even amongst the great special effects, is that with a few notable exceptions, like Robert Downey Jr., like that you just miss that sense of character.
I think you're absolutely right there, because, you know, there was talk at Comic-Con last week where they're going to do the Man of Steel sequel, and they're going to bring in a Batman.
And right, it's going to be like Batman versus Superman.
Right, right. And people like banging. Some people were like, is it going to be Christian Bale? Is it going to be someone new? And I'm like, for these movies, it doesn't matter. Christian Bale's fine. I mean, he's very good in other things, but he's not that great in the Batman movies. It's the cape and the cowl. I mean, who cares who's inside?
Right. Being Batman versus Superman is a great example. It's like at this point, the star is almost completely irrelevant. I mean, even though I thought Henry Cavill did a nice job in Man of Steel, it doesn't matter if he's back. You know, it's the concept. That's what's being sold. The concept, the characters, not really the actors. And yes, it's a cheesy TV movie from 1989. It is what it is. But you know what? There's a real bit of wounded soul to Bixby's Dr. Banner, David Banner. I want to say Bruce Banner, but he wasn't called Bruce on the TV show for reasons I don't understand.
Lots of men pass through here. Working families, migrants. I was hoping you might be one to stay.
So was I.
It's not all hard labor on this spread. Plenty of different jobs.
It's not the work.
What then? A man like you could have a future in a place like this.
Not a man like me.
If there's trouble, you could tell somebody. Somebody might understand. Can't just keep moving on. You gotta stop somewhere.
You have a nice place here. Good luck with it.
Where will you go?
The city.
That's not a good place. People get lost in that city.
You have to stop someplace.
I think if you haven't seen the TV show or the TV movies, take a look. See what you think. You might be kind of pleasantly surprised, cheese and all. So that's The Trial of the Incredible Hulk. It's available to stream on Hulu. What's your last pick, Jordan?
Let's get out of superheroes. All right, let's move on.
Do we have to?
Let's put that aside. Let's prove that we are adults. And let's talk about not comics, but graphic novels. And I want to talk about the film adaptation of Persepolis, Marjane Satrapi's, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, her autobiographical, it was a two books that were collected and turned into a film from, I guess, 2007, 2008, give or take, 2007. And it is, if you haven't seen it or if you haven't heard of it, it's a black and white animated film. Actually, there's some color in there, but it's predominantly black and white. And it is about a young girl coming of age in Iran during the Islamic Revolution. And then she later goes to school in France. And it is really just remembering. It's her life. It's what she remembers. She's a very opinionated young woman. And we see that. We see how. We see her parents. We see the changes in society, and we see it in a very unique and very visual way because the animation is very simple. These are simple line drawings, but they're not. It is sophisticated. It's simple but sophisticated. There are some really clever uses of movement and montage and sort of taking advantage of the elements of animation that are what, you know, why do we read comics in the first place? I mean, it's not just because we're too stupid to read only words. Well, maybe sometimes. But it's because, you know, as the eggheads like to call it, sequential art is it's a definite medium there. You can use it and make it a very sui generis art, form of art. What am I trying to say? Other than using Latin for no reason, I'm saying that when I have to defend comics sometimes, and I do, I'll say, yes, sometimes it's just, you know, a bunch of superheroes flying around. But even with the DC and Marvel stuff, there are times when there are things you can get across that you can express in comics that you can't do in any other medium. And I think that that book is one of them. And I think that this film is very, very true to the book.
Parce qu'on m'a dit, si tu retournes, je sais pas, ceci et cela vont arriver. Mes liens sont toujours et resteraient toujours des liens très, très profonds.
Nous sommes en train de vivre un moment historique.
Ah bah le chat, ah bah le.
Oli, tout de suite.
And so you can watch Persepolis, and you really should. It's in French. I don't know when you stream it, whether it'll be in French or dubbed into English. It's streaming on Amazon. You can purchase it for at some of the other sites as well. Have you seen Persepolis ever?
Of course, yeah. It's a good film. All right. Well, my last pick, we're going to get back into superhero-ish. Not quite a superhero movie, but sort of in that vein. It's certainly more of an indie comic, at least. Or based on an indie comic, I should say. It's the 1994 film The Crow, the original film The Crow, directed by Alex Proyas, which is available now on Netflix. And I don't know, I've definitely seen Batman Returns, at least in, you know, if not the last 2 or 3 years, in the last 5 years at some point. The Crow, I don't think I had seen since the 90s. So I took a look at this before we recorded. And on the one hand, sort of what you were saying, Jordan, about Batman Returns, it feels very dated. It feels very mid-1990s. But sort of like you were saying also about that film, pleasantly dated. You know, it's clearly a film that was made in the wake of Burton's Batman. It has this very dark, very stylized comic book world. It feels very reminiscent, frankly, of, you know, what Burton did with Batman. You know, but there is something to it. You know, it has a style. It has a look. It's interesting to watch. And as great as the Marvel movies are, and they're a great example because the Marvel movies are great. You know, they're a lot of fun. Thor, Captain America, the Avengers, they're all fun, but they all kind of have a sameness about them. They all kind of, by design, they're meant to fit together, so they all kind of have to look the same, and kind of just, by definition, they almost have to be, like, nondescript, nondistinct. And The Crow has much more, it's one of those, like, weirder, funkier movies that I was talking about. It was made almost like an independent movie, it's a Miramax movie. It has a little bit more of an edge to it. And Alex Proyas, a guy who went on to make, you know, Dark City and even iRobot, which I think is not that terrible of a movie. You know, he's got a style to him. He's got a look.
I even liked Knowing. I think Knowing is
pretty I never saw Knowing, so I can't say. But
Knowing is pretty. But have you seen, there's like 75 sequels to this. Have you seen any of those?
I've never seen any of them. I've never really understood why you would make, frankly, another one. Because to me, it was always like the appeal of the movie was certainly the look of it, the Alex Proyas, you know, the direction. But then the other thing was Brandon Lee, who, of course, you know, famously was tragically killed when they're making the movie. And I do think part of what gives the film kind of a strange appeal, and as I was watching it, a little bit of it again this week, it is an eerie film to watch knowing what happened. I mean, I'm pretty sure that Brandon Lee was actually killed filming the scene where his character was killed. The character is sort of this supernatural guy who comes back from the dead to basically avenge his own murder and the murder of his girlfriend or whatever. So there is this kind of strange blend of the reality of the story and the reality of our world. And there is this interesting thing where, you know, the character dies and comes back to life, and it's almost this fantasy of what we wish could happen with Brandon Lee, you know, and in a way almost did in the context of it made him a star, you know, tragically after the fact, posthumously. The movie comes out and it's a hit and everyone loves it and he gives a very good performance, and it sort of was like he almost became this larger than life figure after the fact. So there's this whole, like, meta-text around the movie that is almost unavoidable. I guess now if you just picked it up, you had no idea, you might not know the background about Brandon Lee and the fact that he was killed. But it certainly was – it was inescapable when the movie came out.
Oh, it was a big deal, yeah.
And I think people now, you know, just the minimum of research, you would know this. And I think it does kind of make the movie interesting because the character is about coming back to life and is about death and revenge and all these things.
Mr. Gideon.
Who?
I'm not paying attention. I repeat, a gold engagement ring, yes?
It was pawned here a year ago by a customer of yours named Tintin.
He confided in me before he ran out of breath.
I would say, you know, I haven't seen any of the sequels. Some of the sequels are available on Netflix. Proceed at your own peril there. But the original movie, The Original Crow from 1994, that's one worth checking out. That's available on Netflix.
The Chitauri are coming. Nothing will change that. What have I to fear?
The Avengers. That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team. Earth's mightiest heroes type thing.
Yes. I've met them.
Yeah. Takes us a while to get any traction, I'll give you that one. But let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod. A super soldier, living legend, who kind of lives up to the legend. A man with breathtaking anger management issues. A couple of master assassins, and you, big fella. You've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
Not a great plan. When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
So the Avengers. Excuse me, Jordan. Marvel's the Avengers.
Say it right. Say
Marvel's
it right.
Marvel's the Avengers. With $1.5 billion grossed worldwide, I imagine most people in the listening audience have probably seen this movie already and formed their own opinions about it. I don't think we're going to be surprising anybody, but I still thought it might be interesting to look back at the movie now for this reason. The movie was released a little over a year ago, last summer, and actually Jordan and I saw the movie together at this crazy movie marathon that AMC Theaters did, where they showed every single Marvel movie up to the Avengers in a marathon and then premiered the Avengers at midnight, like Thursday night at midnight. So we were amongst the first people to see the movie, and the place, which was full of, you know, comic book nerds who put us to shame, I would say. You know, we were on the low spectrum of insanity. They went absolutely crazy. It was one of the most enthusiastic responses I've ever witnessed for a movie, and it was infectious.
It was like being at the Muppet Theater, you know, where they're just flinging one another in the air, popcorn going in all directions. It was crazy.
It was bananas, and I had a great time. And I remember, you know, and this was like a day where we watched something like 12 hours of movies straight with no break, and I remember we were flagging a little in the middle of the day. These were all movies we'd seen before, with the exception of The Avengers. And I remember, though, after The Avengers, I went home. It's like 3 in the morning by the time I get home, and I could not sleep. I was so amped on the movie. I'd had so much fun, and the excitement in the air was just so infectious. But I think that the buildup around the movie in general, and about some of these major comic book movies, it can get like that. You can get swept up in the hype, in the excitement. You know, there's so much anticipation about The Avengers or The Dark Knight Rises or Man of Steel or one of these movies that, you know, sometimes you get swept up in it too. It can be exciting. And so sometimes your opinion can change. It can change one way or the other. You can find your opinion of it has, you know, cooled, or maybe you felt you were against the hype and you didn't like it, and then your opinion changes. So I thought now would be a good time to look back with a little bit of hindsight, a little bit of a clearer head. We've pulled the Tesseract spear out of our hearts. We're no longer under Loki's mind control, so we can think more clearly. So my question to you, Jordan, is this. What did you think of The Avengers when you saw it the first time last year, and what do you think about it now, and has your opinion of the movie changed?
I think my opinion of the movie has not changed, having looked at it again and having watched it since that first night up until today. It's just a very watchable film. I'm going to give you a great example. I do a lot of flying, And whenever I go to the restroom at the back of the plane and I come back out, there's always somebody watching the Avengers. And I'm always kind of like looking over the shoulder for a second. It's like, oh, that's the scene where this happens. Or there's that zing that's coming up. You know, there's the funny line about Galaga is going to be happening here. So it's just a very – it's just a really fun time, and it's very engaging. I will say, though, it's not by any stretch a perfect film. I mean, I think it's so good at what it does, and it's the, really as good as these kind of summer tentpoles can be. But the first half does kind of lag a little bit. Really up until the first fight on the helicarrier, there's a lot of talking, but it's still very fun talking because you love the characters and you love the interplay, but I can't lie and say that it's Shakespeare. You know, it's funny. I think about the fact that this is the third most highest grossing film out there. And like you say, everybody's seen it. What do people who saw this that never see movies think of it? You know, movies like Titanic or Avatar or whatever. Those are the types of movies that people who never go to the movies see. That's why they become phenomenons. They make a zillion dollars. So there had to have been a lot of people who had never heard of these characters that went and said, oh, we got to see this movie everybody's talking about. What are they thinking during the first half? Because not only is it you need a little bit of background, it's also like, you know, this guy Thor is yelling at this dude with a shield and it's just ridiculous. But then once you get to the second half, it's just so propulsive and so energetic. And the characters are just really a lot of fun. I think the sequence that everybody loves, where it's just that fluid computer generated shot of watching all of the characters battle the Chitauri in ways that are specific to their talents, is the movie sort of summed up in one shot. You know, it's like they're working as a team, but they all have their own individual shtick, and it just really zooms on by. So I think it definitely stands the test of time, but I can't lie and say that it's not like Casablanca, where every single scene is like, oh my god, this is just humming on all the, you know, it's they're definitely, you know, let's be realistic about it is what I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I mostly agree with you. I think, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back at it now, I think, you know, the strengths of the movie really hold up. It's almost like the strengths seem stronger and some of the weaknesses seem weaker. You know, like you're able to see the flaws a little more clearly, I think. But also you do appreciate how good a lot of it is. And you mentioned that there is so much talking in the middle of the movie, and certainly the weakest part is sort of that kind of sluggish middle part. The opening is certainly no great shakes, but then right after that opening, the first opening with the shield shenanigans, then you get the sort of like the building the team part, which I actually think is really well done with all the different members getting their individual scenes, and I think all of those work really well. But the thing that really kind of makes it is the fact that, you know, it's a well-written movie, and you have Joss Whedon's voice coming through very clearly, and the fact that, you know, he's able to enliven some of those more sluggish moments. And the fact that it is a little longer and a little slower at times actually kind of harkens back to some of those earlier movies that I enjoyed that were a little bit more about character, and then they could be a little quirkier. You know, there's like a Galaga bit, you know, like that I did not remember from the first time, that there's a guy, one of the S.H.I.E.L.D. guys is playing Galaga on the helicarrier.
That's my favorite part of the whole movie.
I totally missed that the first time. I didn't remember it. I was so enraptured, I guess, I was so lost in a few. I was in an Avengers fugue state, I guess. I didn't remember that. So, yeah, I love that little stuff, all the little touches like that. You know, that he clearly understands the characters as a longtime comic book fan, and he gives them all great little moments, and you're right. And then that big finale is really fun and really well made, and it looks fantastic, and it might even look better at home, although the Netflix, which, you know, I don't know if we've mentioned yet, the movie is available on Netflix streaming. The Netflix copy, I don't think, is HD, which is a knock against it. But on the plus side, it's not in 3D, which was how we saw it.
Yeah.
And you certainly don't miss anything not having it in 3D this time. I actually enjoyed rewatching it not in 3D. So I would say yes. I would agree with you in large part that, you know, it's a very fun, very watchable movie. It holds up well. It's a very well-made movie. It's a home run in most regards. It has a few problems. Let's segue here into another question about this movie, which is, Jordan, can you explain to me what is Loki's plan?
I'm going to try. He's got the Cosmic Cube, which is called
the Tesseract.
He is going to bring the Chitauri, which are the Skrulls or whatever you want to call them, to Earth to make humanity bow at his feet, I guess. Yeah, no, he has no clear plan. He doesn't know. I think he really just wants to show up his brother. He's just upset at Thor. But, I mean, I guess the question is, yes, so if the Chitauri were to defeat the armies of the world, you know, what next? I mean, what, does the economy keep going? You know, what sort of political system is there? Like, is it just he sits in a chair and has just people throw themselves at him? I mean,
I guess. I mean, that I'm almost less confused
by
that.
Wait, no, it's not Loki. He's doing it on behalf of Thanos at the end.
He doesn't know he's working for Thanos. As far as we know in the movie, you know, this is his shtick. He's doing this all – he's doing all of this because he wants to conquer Earth. And like you said, I think he does want to sit on a throne and rule. My question is, like, how does he expect to get there by, like, being captured by the Avengers for a while and staying on the ship and making them all angry? You know, it's like the pink slime gag from Ghostbusters 2. It's like, oh, they're really angry and it's going to, you know, ruin everything. But then they become friends again. But then he uncaptures himself, if that's a word. Yeah. And then he just shows up in New York. Like, the whole time they're searching, where does he have it? And then at the end, it just kind of shows up in New York at the top of Stark Tower. Yeah, it just – and then the whole thing with these Chitauri, and it's like, what do they want? They want to come here? Why do they want
– No, that's in the very first shot. The very first shot is – it's what we later learn is Thanos is sending the Chitauri and saying, our man – well, you know, it's like the implication is that they're in cahoots, but I guess it's Thanos is pulling Loki's puppet strings. Is that it? I can't believe we're talking about this a year later. I mean, that's what's ridiculous.
But that's kind of my point, though.
Yeah, the movie is so energetic that you just come out singing and whistling a happy tune. And, it, you know, General Zod in Man of Steel and in Superman 2 had a much better plan for world domination. Superman 2, he goes to the White House, and in Man of Steel, he's planning to blow the whole place up with the world engine. You got to give it to DC for making their evil mastermind plans a little bit more understandable, because I right now can't remember what the hell Loki's trying to do.
But I think it's unbelievable. Well, it's not even a matter of remembering. Like, I just watched this movie again last night, and it's not a matter of remembering. I was watching it this time and paying a little more attention and not being quite so caught up in the sort of the energy and the spectacle, which I'm still enjoying. I'm sitting there going, this doesn't make any sense. Like, none of it. Like, I don't understand any of it. And maybe people will write into us, you know, at our feedback email, SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, and explain to me. And I'm sure they'll be very polite and pleasant and will in no way be angry at me or say hateful, spiteful things.
They'll call you a fake geek girl is what they'll call you.
Well, I hope not. But it is kind of fascinating that you can make a movie that feels this good and is this enjoyable that doesn't have a plot that makes any sense whatsoever.
Well, in the movie's defense, though, I mean, Loki is a character that you kind of just have to trust. I mean, you're watching him do this thing and you're discovering it with him. And I guess there's a part of your brain that instinctually says, you know, so far Loki has been pretty sharp. If this next step is going to work, he's going to know. Because so far everything he's done has worked in his favor. So if when the Chitauri invade and defeat Earth's Mightiest Heroes assembled, you know, then he's going to move on to stage six of his plan, which is, but then we never see it because of what happens.
Right. Well, I don't know. I was curious if you would be. I was hoping you would be able to.
He wants to take it over. He's going to use the monsters to shut everybody up, and he's going to sit in a chair and laugh.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I mean, the other thing that I think is worth kind of hitting home is the fact that, you know, so many of these of the comic book movies, even the ones that I enjoy, that they really are, you know, they're just sort of like they're great delivery devices for spectacle, for special effects, for these amazing stunts and visuals and computer generated, awesomeness. But and this movie has that for sure. There are some spectacular visuals. You mentioned that one great shot that's one long take, and we see each member of the team, and it kind of segues smoothly from one to the next to the next, and that's all fantastic. But it doesn't feel like a movie that's sort of like in service of the effects. It feels like the effects and the action and the excitement are in the service of the characters, actually. Even though Loki and all of his nonsense doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you do sort of feel the tension between him and Thor. And you're right, like it clearly is about their rivalry. And so you have all the stuff with Thor and Loki, and you have all the great stuff with Iron Man and with Captain America, and even the little characters like Black Widow and Hawkeye to probably the least extent. It actually does feel like it's about the characters first, and if not about their development, quote unquote, then it's about the interplay and the dialogue. And like, sure, there's lots of people who haven't, like you said, you know, because the movie made so much money that it's on a scale of like Titanic or Avatar, where people didn't see the previous movies. But it sort of takes for granted to a certain extent that you have a basic familiarity with these characters, and maybe you've seen the first movie, so you understand sort of like that's where like the character development for each individual character belongs. And what the Avengers is for is to see them play off one another, and so you get all these great little sort of riffs between the characters. You know, like there's the scenes between Tony Stark and Bruce Banner where you get to see how these guys kind of interact and how two super science geniuses kind of work together. And then there's the scene where Captain America and Iron Man have to work together to like save the helicarrier. Yeah, that's a fantastic scene.
There's great permutations throughout. I mean, everybody right. gets a moment to play with somebody else, and you've really nailed it, because that's what separates the wheat from the chaff and separates the men from the boys. It's some of these films are just spectacle and that's it. And you come away with a sugar high, and some of them you actually feel something resonate. And, you know, a piece of garbage, like, it's not technically a comic book movie, but, you know, Van Helsing, the Hugh Jackman vehicle, is, you know, it's got a lot of characters and a lot of zipping around with computer-generated images, and it's just junk. You don't give a darn about any of them. But Avengers, even if you haven't been building up to it with the previous five films, I think there's good writing and good performances, and there's like charismatic characters enough that even a newcomer will care about those scenes where they're just talking. And, you know, we were saying before that some of the movie feels a little overly talky. It's still the stuff that is there by and large is quite good. So, you know, that's the key differentiator when it's, you know, one of these movies where it's just, you know, it just feels like an exploitation film, which has its place. You know, grab a six pack and go to the midnight screening and hoot and holler. But it's not, you know, there's a reason that the Avengers, you know, sort of rose to the top. Whereas, you know, I don't know, the Underworld series or some of the other ones did not quite. The Resident Evil movies are a lot of fun and they have a fan base, but, you know, they're garbage. And I've seen it, and I love the Resident Evil movies, but I love them like I love a giant bowl of Frosted Flakes, you know? I mean, it's not a real thing.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered it. We could probably talk for hours about this, but I don't know if anyone but us would be entertained by that. And that is The Avengers. It is available to stream. If you're by some chance you haven't seen it yet, or you want to go back and rewatch it, it's available now to stream on Netflix and also on Amazon Prime. All right, we're going to wrap things up this episode, of course, with Behind the Eight Ball, our countdown of three new films on streaming, two listener recommendations, and one film chosen blindly by number from my queue. Allison's not here. I've got my picks here. I didn't make Jordan go through it. This. It's a very time-consuming process. I didn't want to keep Jordan any longer than I had to. So we've got my Behind the Eight Ball, but he's going to chime in where necessary, where he feels like he wants to chime in. And here we go. Are you ready to begin, Jordan?
I'm ready to chime. Bring
okay.
on the eight ball.
Fantastic. Here we All right, here we go. Starting with three new releases. First up, The film Shut Up and Play the Hits is a 2012 documentary. It's available now on Netflix. It's a concert film about LCD Sound System, the band, their farewell concert at Madison Square Garden. The next film is available now on Hulu. It's a also a documentary, not a music documentary, though. It's called Pulling John. I saw this film a few years ago at the South by Southwest Film Festival. It's a documentary about the world of competitive arm wrestling. So it's one of these documentaries sort of about a subculture where you kind of get brought into this world that you'd never really knew before, but the people in it are really obsessed and crazed about it. And I always like these kind of documentaries. And this one is a solid one, and it's about the world of arm wrestling. It's about this guy who's been the champion arm wrestler for years and years, and a couple of guys who are now sort of like challenging for his throne. They're nipping at his heels. So that's Pulling John.
That sounds terrific. I haven't seen it, but that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. That's Pulling John, available on Hulu. And finally, a double feature, both available on Netflix, by director Alex Karpovsky, Rubberneck and Red Flag, two different movies by the same filmmaker, Alex Karpovsky, who you might know now as one of the actors on Girls, the HBO series.
It's Ray. Ray on Girls.
He's the character Ray.
Yeah, he plays Ray.
That's right. In Red Flag, he plays it's a comedy, and he plays basically Alex Karpovsky, in quotation marks, a indie filmmaker. He's on a road trip. In Rubberneck, he plays a scientist named Paul, and that movie is more of a drama. It's sort of like an obsessive thriller kind of thing where he becomes obsessed with a coworker, and that kind of drives him crazy. I actually never saw either of these movies, although I am a fan of Karpovsky's work as an actor. Jordan, did you see these?
I've seen them both.
And would you recommend them?
I recommend them both.
Ah, fantastic.
But they're very different. Red Flag is very, very lo-fi, very laid back. It's funny. And it's got the usual gang from these movies. Jennifer Prediger, I think is how you pronounce her last name, plays the wacky girl. You know her from some of the Swanberg films. And the guy is actually an acquaintance of mine who plays the goofy friend. And I can't pronounce his name correctly, so it's embarrassing. He's
not a very good friend. Are you?
Well, he's of Turkish origin. I don't know how to pronounce the last name. I think it's Tukel. His name is Onur Tukel. He was also in Septian, and he made his own movie called Richard's Wedding, which is hilarious. You got to see Richard's Wedding. Another one of these sort of I'm not going to use the M word and say what the word I'm thinking.
Mumblecore.
But I'm not saying that word. He's involved with the group of people, as is Karpovsky. So, that's Red Flag. It's funny. It's not hilarious, but it's lo-fi, kind of like
solid.
Have a patch blue ribbon and watch this movie. Rubberneck is very interesting. It's a psychological drama, it's a very interesting performance from Karpovsky also, because he's usually, playing, kind of a New York schlub.
Right.
And in this, he's playing...
he's a Boston schlub, no.
He's a Boston schlub, but also he's he works in a science lab. He's very introverted, and you discover secrets, and it ultimately gets to a violent place.
Mm.
And did not expect that at all. And I think I like Rubberneck more than I like Red Flag. Because Red Flag, although it's fun, you've seen it before. Rubberneck is pretty damn interesting.
All right, great. So that's Rubberneck and Red Flag, two different films, and Jordan recommended them both there, and they're both available on Netflix. Now we've got two listener recommendations for you. The first is from Charlie in Chicago, and he writes in and says, last night, my girlfriend and I watched a movie that I haven't seen since it was in theaters, and she had never seen it at all. It was 1993's Heart and Souls. Now streaming on Netflix Instant. I don't think I've ever even heard of this movie, Jordan.
Let me go to the Google machine.
All right. Well, I'm going to read you what Charlie says here. He says it features a superb cast, including Charles Grodin, Kira Sedgwick, Alfred Woodard, Tom Sizemore, Elizabeth Shue, and Robert Downey Jr. in another of his great roles. The premise is a little complex. It's about four recently deceased ghosts being forever tied to a recently birthed baby boy. Only he can see them. And they must always be within 10 feet of him. Also, they can possess him. Also, there's a ghost bus. And then Charlie writes, it's a little much on paper, but I feel the movie handles the ghost rules exposition pretty solidly and also serves the characters well before the plot takes off. And honestly, I got misty about every 5 minutes. All the beats feel straight out of a quirky 50s comedy while still being a cutesy 90s romance. that was made specifically to appeal to baby boomers. If you can let go of the calcified cynicism that comes with adulthood, I think you'll find a pretty enjoyable time waiting for you. So that's Heart and Souls, available on Netflix. That's from Charlie. I've never heard of this movie. I'm going to add it to my queue. It sounds intriguing.
It sounds intriguing. I'm looking at the poster now. So the poster looks familiar. So I know that this guy's not making it up. what a cast. David Paymer, Tom Sizemore, Chucky Grodin. I mean, forget about it. B.B. King is in the film also as himself. The director, Ron Underwood, has a mixed bag. He started off well with Tremors and City Slickers. Mm-hmm. His most recent film was Santa Baby 2. And he also did The Adventures of Pluto Nash. So, I mean, hey, he's kind of all over the place. But it sounds to me like, Look Who's Talking meets Here Comes Mr. Jordan or something. It sounds interesting. Yeah, I'd be willing to put it in my queue. It's a great cast. Why not?
All right. Well, thank you for that recommendation. We've got one more recommendation here. This one's from Josh, who writes in and says, this may seem weird, but after the unfortunate passing of Dennis Farina, the great actor who passed away last week, he says, I watched Stealing Harvard on Netflix Instant. While critically derided and commercially ignored, this was a favorite of mine as a preteen, and Farina is great as Leslie Mann's overbearing and creepy father. It's still pretty funny and deserves another look. So that's Stealing Harvard, and it's available on Netflix. I'm trying to remember if I saw this movie. Oh, right, with Jason Lee and Tom Green. I have to admit, I might have seen this one. It's directed by Bruce McCullough.
I never saw it. Bruce McCullough directed it. No joke. Bruce McCullough from The Kids in the Hall. The greatest of The Kids in the Hall.
I think I did see it, and I don't think I liked it. But you know what? I might be inclined to check it out again on Josh's recommendation.
What was the Harvard movie? What was the Harvard movie with Joe Pesci?
I don't know.
He did a movie set in Harvard called like
All right.
Because that's what I thought that he was talking about.
You look that up, and I'm going to go on to our last part of Behind the Eight Ball here because we're going very long. Our last part is the one random film chosen blindly from my queue by number. And I had Jordan, without even knowing what he was doing, I had Jordan give me a random number. He gave me number 56. Are you ready to find what random thing you picked, Jordan?
I want to know.
The television series Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. How about that on our episode
perfect.
That's right. The cartoon series from the 80s, of course, the classic Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. The premise of this show was a Spider-Man show with his amazing friends were Iceman and Firestar, a character who was created for the show, but then later became a comic book character in her own right with a history and complex continuity all its own. But I watched the show as a kid, and I think they added it recently to Netflix Instant, so I threw it on there for a potential nostalgia view. I haven't gotten around to watching any of it yet. I don't know how well it holds up, but I do remember vividly the show and also the credit sequence where Spider-Man is like swinging around on the logo and the announcer is singing like Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and da da da. Anyway, so that was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the complete epic series.
I never watched Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, but I hope it still holds some merit for you because it stinks to go back and see something that you loved as a kid not stand up. So.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a classic. Well, I'll find out at some point because it is available now to stream on Netflix.
Would you like to know the name of the Joe Pesci Harvard
Absolutely.
Movie?
What was it?
It's called With Honors.
Oh, With Honors.
Yeah, that's what I thought this guy was talking about. Not the Tom Green movie directed by Bruce McCullough, which...
No, that was a different movie.
Yeah.
And With Honors, if you had said the movie where with the Madonna theme song, I might have gotten it. Because that's what I always think of it as, with the song by Madonna in it. But anyway, I'm so glad we cleared that up. It would have really... It would have destroyed me not to know. This is the part of the show normally where we go through our listeners' choice options for our next episode. We don't need to do that because we've already decided, or you guys have already decided, our next listener's choice review is going to be Orange is the New Black, the Netflix original series. So start watching that now. In 2 weeks, we'll be back with that review, and we will dive in, hopefully, to the complete series. I'm going to try to watch the entire thing. I know Allison has already watched it all. She's raring to go and ready to discuss it. So
everybody loves it, and I'm getting – I'm a big Star Trek guy, and I've been getting
really?
Texts – Yeah. Well, maybe not all the listeners know that I also write a weekly column for StarTrek.com called One Trek Mind.
No, it's... yes. But
I've been getting texts ever since this Orange is the New Black started because Janeway's in it. I mean, she's got a real name. Her name is Kate McCrew.
I was going to say the actress who played Janeway.
Captain Janeway is apparently in it, and she kills, apparently. She's apparently wonderful. And I've been getting texts from people from far-flung places saying, are you watching Orange is the New Black? My wife has watched the first few episodes, and she loves it. She's watched 8, she just told me. I didn't even know she was in the room. But she's watched 8 of them so far. And I haven't seen it yet, but I'm also not Allison, so you're not going to talk about it with me. But maybe we'll talk about it. IRL.
That's right. That's right. In the meantime, before that episode, be sure to go to filmspottingsvu.com where you can find our show archive as well as a list to direct links of all the movies and TV shows we discuss on the show. Our Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with that Orange is the New Black review. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter, at Matt Singer. You can also follow the show on Twitter, at FilmspottingSVU. And you can follow Jordan on Twitter. Jordan, what's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is jhoffman6, J-H-O-F-F-M-A-N, and then the numeral 6.
All right. Well, Jordan, I want to thank you so much for joining me. This has been a very fun conversation. I can't imagine doing it with anybody else. No one else would have been as nerdy and as non-disapproving as you were. You were so welcoming and embracing my
pitheticness. Well, I embrace it so long as it's canonical and does not breach any, you know, so long as it's all within universe, it's okay with me.
Oh, fantastic. Is there anything else you want to plug while you're here? Anything else people should check out? You wrote a great list. You ranked, I think the listeners would be into this, you ranked every single Woody Allen movie ever this week at film.com. It was an impressive list. I don't think you should spoil it, but I think people should go find it at film.com. Take a look. I'm sure we have some Woody Allen fans will be interested to see your rankings and compare them with their own. But again, thank you so much for filling in for Allison this week. It was really appreciated. I had a good time. I hope you did too.
I did as well. Yes.
All right. Well, for Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening.